Dreams are an important part of surrealism. After all, dreams allow us to tap into our subconscious. And one filmmaker who has definitely tapped into the power of dreams and the subconscious is David Lynch. Lynch has served up some pretty surreal images in his films, including a grotesque baby that looks like an alien, and a severed human ear lying in a field. Lynch's disturbing visual images overshadow the way he's used sound in his movies. David Hughes is the author of The Complete Lynch. This comprehensive study of Lynch's work draws on an interview that Hughes did with Lynch. Hughes recalls his first meeting with David Lynch in Prague.
I arrived the night before he was due to get in, and I sat up like most of the night writing my questions and rereading them and study, because I knew I had like one shot at this and I only had a couple of hours with him. And it's a good job I did, because at, you know, some ungodly hour of the morning, I was rudely awakened by the phone going in my hotel room. And it was David Lynch yelling at me, and he goes, hi, this is David. We could do the interview now if you like, because I'm a smoker, see? So I could do it in the bar. Is that okay? And he was exactly like his character in the Twin Peaks series when he played that kind of slightly deaf.
The guy who talks a little too loud.
Yeah, exactly. So it was just amazing. It was the most perfect kind of introduction to Lynch the man.
And maybe you needed to be a little sleepy to say yes at that point.
Exactly. Well, I kind of hurried down and, you know, there he was negotiating a sandwich and a cup of coffee, which seemed perfect. Presumably no cherry pie in Prague, unfortunately. But anyway, so he was there and the interview ensued. And I could see pretty quickly that he was going to be, you know, as cagey as his reputation had suggested he would be. So I would ask him things like, weren't you working on a film at some point? You were developing a film called Up at the Lake. And he would say, I don't remember. And then I'd say, well, you know, let me remind you then, because I talked to some other people who were involved in that. And so, really? And then I'd say, and it was kind of about this, blah, blah, blah. And I'd remind him a little bit. He'd say, I sort of remember it had a lake and something had happened up at the lake.
You almost could have done this interview without him.
I spent just long enough with him and watching interviews with him or whatever to kind of, you know, to get a feel for how he talks about it. It was amazing. Actually,
Was he smiling as he said these things to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and he would have these amazing sort of Pinter-esque pauses between words, you know, between question and answer. There would be like a pause while he'd like drink an entire cup of coffee, and then he'd answer and say, well, not really. You know? or you're looking at the donut. You should be looking at the hole.
I want to ask you about David Lynch's first feature film, Eraserhead. It's a very strange story of a young man and the way he deals with fatherhood, among other things. But what did you think of Eraserhead the first time you saw it?
You know, at that point, literally, I'd not seen anything like that before, because nobody had. You know, it was a movie that kind of got under your skin in a way that movies really didn't. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, aside from the obvious things that the narrative structure seemed particularly strange, that the lead character wasn't like any movie character you'd ever seen before, but it was also the fact that the sound was doing very strange things and kind of getting under your skin and really reaching you on a level that you weren't normally, that you weren't used to having accosted while you're in the cinema.
Right, I mean, that sound I've heard it on soundtrack recordings, which astonishes me that anybody would put it out, because it's a kind of an industrial, constant, irritating noise.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very bizarre, and it's a way of kind of dislocating the viewer from his own reality in a way. And I think one of the inspirations for that may have been Stanley Kubrick, because David Lynch is a huge fan of Stanley Kubrick. And in 2001, A Space Odyssey, Kubrick used sound in a very interesting way. Whenever you were inside the spaceship, which you were a lot, he would put this kind of extra layer of sound that was just like a constant hum. And as soon as you cut to a shot of space, he would cut that off. And you suddenly felt the vacuum. You know, you felt the absence of sound, of a sound that you didn't know had been there. Now, Lynch kind of, you know, whether he learned from that or whether he just kind of took that on board and decided that he wanted to make his own. So he used sound effects, not in the traditional sense, but this kind of weird combination of sound and music. You couldn't really call it music. It's like, this weird industrial kind of constant clamor, really. And he used it in a way to kind of, like, put the audience off its game, so they didn't know really what they were. Not only did they not know what they were looking at, but they didn't know what they were listening to either. Right. It wasn't a kind of traditional movie score.
Yeah. Sound is obviously very important to Lynch. He pays a lot of attention to not just the pictures, but also to what people are listening to at the same time.
Absolutely, and it's extraordinary the difference listening to a film or watching a film like Lost Highway and Eraserhead at the cinema, or now I guess on a good DVD system with like surround sound or whatever. You know, the way he plays with sound is really quite extraordinary. And one of my little bits of Lynch memorabilia that I have is a notice that Lynch sent out to the projectionists who were going to be playing Mulholland Drive. And it was this little kind of, this little note that he wrote and had kind of printed up and laminated and whatever, and it said, like, dear projectionist, I know this is unusual, but please bear with me, and I do need your help. And what he basically asked the projectionist to do was to crank the sound a little, like a decibel or, you know, a few decibels higher than they normally would, because he wanted the sound to be a major part of the movie experience. And a film like Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive and even Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, there's a sequence of that movie which was a kind of a prequel to the TV show of Twin Peaks, which was, you know, the TV show was of course hugely successful, but the film didn't do so well. But now it's widely regarded among Lynch aficionados as one of his true masterpieces.
Right.
But there was a sequence in that film where he deliberately cranks the music so loud in a nightclub scene that you can't hear what the characters are saying to each other. And it's very, very kind of disquieting, because you know that you don't need to know the exact words that they're saying, but you're obviously trying to figure out what it is, and you're trying to straining to hear,
right.
Or you know, reaching for the subtitle channel if you're watching it on DVD, only to be frustrated by Lynch because he doesn't put subtitles on the DVD. But you know, while you're watching that, it's like, when would you see that in a movie? When would you see a scene where it's deliberately mixed? You know, now it's like something that you can see more and more. I mean, you can look at the opening sequence rather of Saving Private Ryan, for instance, and see the way that sound is used in that film. Or a film like Black Hawk Down, where, you know, you've got kind of people yelling at each other over helicopter noise or whatever, and it's sort of indistinct. But it's really very, very unusual. It was a very unusual move at that time. And, you know, the distributors get a little panicked and they say, well, we have to subtitle this scene because nobody will know what they're talking about if you mix it that loud.
Yeah, of course, you could put in a subtitle that says, can't understand or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Ununderstandable dialogue. What about the music? Angelo Badalamenti seems to be Lynch's composer of choice. First of all, I guess, is that true, do you think? And if it is, do you have a favorite Badalamenti score?
Well, I think the music to Twin Peaks is still pretty memorable. I think, you know, it's one of those things that if you kind of stop the man in the street and said, can you remember what the Twin Peaks music was like? You know, they might be able to recognize it, or they might be able to, you can't exactly whistle it because it's not that kind of sound, but it's very distinctive.
One of the things about David Lynch that seems so obvious once you begin to talk about it is that he must be a man of incredible ability with detail. I was reading through the synopses of the movies that he made in your book, The Complete Lynch. Some of these movies, when you try to explain them, don't make any sense at all. Watching them is a very different experience, but they're all of these different things. They're all of the different characters. They're all of the different ideas that are going on. You never know quite what's coming next. The music is there. The sound is there. Then you have things like, was that just David Lynch I saw appearing in this? And then you have the things that make you step back from the film. These are very rich experiences.
Yeah, which is why his films stand up so well to repeat viewing, and also why I think that they can't be really pinned down, you know, that they do feel kind of dreamlike. I mean, Lost Highway is a kind of almost endlessly cyclical movie that you could kind of watch it play itself out over and over again. You know, it's a very kind of strange imbalance of narrative that it seems to kind of start at a point when you feel like you're coming into the movie late and finish at a point where you don't think it's quite done yet. You know, he just gets back on the highway and is kind of driving off. And so you can't apply normal interpretations to his movies in the same way that you can with the work of other directors. And I wouldn't necessarily say lesser directors, it's just that there are, you know, different kinds of movies. You don't necessarily want to, you know, if you're making a movie as partisan, let's say as JFK, then you don't necessarily want to leave it open to interpretation. Whereas if you're making a film like Capturing the Freedmans, the recent documentary, you know, you do want a little bit of ambiguity in there. You want to leave room for the audience to make up his own mind. And that's really what Lynch is doing. He's saying that, well, no two interpretations, even if they conflict, are necessarily wrong. You know, they may both be right. And, you know, your interpretation is as valid as mine. And I think that's a great way for an artist to approach his audience, for him to not explode the myths of his work and say, oh yes, you know, this is what that means, this is what that's about, because, you know, it's that old Kierkegaard thing that if you label me, you negate me. And as soon as Lynch comes out and says, well, Mulholland Drive is about this, beyond what the plot appears to be, such as it is, you know, Mulholland Drive means this, then you're like, all the people who took their own interpretation and are enjoying having that interpretation, that they've, you know, that's
like
that's evaporated for them.
Right.
Yeah, or it's like sort of taking it away from them. So I got to admire Lynch for refusing to do the DVD commentaries and to go into the background of his movie and explain how things were done.
Just one last question. What do you see as David Lynch's contribution to cinema writ large?
I think his greatest contribution is that he's tapped into dreams that we wouldn't necessarily wish to have, but that he's managed to kind of appeal to our dream life, to go beneath the conscious mind and appeal to us on a level that very few films actually reach. You know, he gets us with the sound, he gets us with the bizarro images that we can't get out of our heads. He gives us indelible images that will stay with us for the rest of our lives, whether we want them to or not, you know? And I think that's his greatest contribution, is that he is the director who's most closely tapped into our dreams. A lot of directors are going to tap into our fears. There's a lot of horror movies out there, but Lynch isn't really making horror movies. I think he has this ability to tap into something that feels dreamlike, and there are very few directors like that, very few artists like that, but he's certainly one of the best.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer like dreamers do. Then I fall asleep to dream
That's Roy Orbison with In Dreams, a song that's featured in David Lynch's film Blue Velvet. David Hughes is the author of a book called The Complete Lynch.